Hello, and welcome to the Computing Conversations column. This column is from the May 2013 issue of IEEE Computer and is titled Bob Metcalf, Ethernet at 40. There is supporting video material for this column that you can find in the IEEE Computer Society YouTube channel or in the IEEE Digital Library. I'm the editor of the column, and I'm Charles Severance from the University of Michigan. It's pretty much impossible today to find computing technology that doesn't support Ethernet or that didn't evolve from it, such as Wi-Fi. We simply assume that everything from our phones to our laptops to our printers and backup systems come with ready-to-plug-in high-speed wired or wireless network. In fact, many homes now have both a wired and a wireless local area network. But 40 years ago, LANs didn't even exist. The typical approach to distributed computing was to connect terminals in offices throughout a building with serial cables that ran from the back of the terminal to the mainframe. Sometimes this connection was done through phone lines and a dial-up modem. I recently spoke with Bob Metcalf, who described how the Ethernet local area network was invented 40 years ago at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center on May 22, 1973. Metcalf is quick to point out that many brilliant engineers contributed to Ethernet and other popular forms of high-speed local area networking over the years. Although it's an incorrect oversimplification to give him sole credit for inventing it, Metcalf was definitely on the front lines all those years ago. In the quest to build the office of the future during the early 1970s, the creative people at Park decided that instead of having terminals connected to a single computer, they would give every person a personal computer and connect those computers together, according to Metcalf.
I was extraordinarily lucky and happened to be at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center when a problem evolved that had never before occurred. The problem had never occurred, and that was the problem of having a building full of personal computers. And I was the networking guy, so they turned to me and said, network these puppies. Now, we had just finished starting the Internet. It was then called the ARPANET, which was packet switching. And it was pretty clear we wanted this network to connect to the, it wasn't yet called Internet thing. So it would be packet switched, we were pretty sure.
There was also a desire to connect the personal computers of the future with the printers of the future.
At the same time, we were building, arguably, I don't want to get into that argument, the first laser printer. Which, in our case, the first one, whose name was Ears, that's a whole other story, it was a page per second, 500 dots per inch, and if you do the math, that's about 20 megabits per second. So the existing methods of interconnection had a lot of problems. One is they were all home run, so all these wires, one from every desk, would all come to this one place in the building and put a big rat's nest. We called it a rat's nest, by the way. Two is they generally ran at 300 bits per second, or if you really rev them up, they go to 14.4 kilobits per second. And that wasn't even close to 20 megabits per second. So, and we wanted to be able to keep the printer busy by sending documents from all these PCs, which hadn't been built yet.
Charles Simony designed an earlier effort to network personal computers called SIGNET, Simony's Infinitely Glorious Network. But Metcalf felt it was too complex and wanted something simpler. He came across a wireless network in use at the University of Hawaii.
And it was in the course of investigating how to organize this LAN that I ran into a packet, by accident, a packet radio network at the University of Hawaii. It was called the AlohaNet. And what was beautiful about the Aloha network is it solved a distributed problem. That is, how would we share a radio channel back to the mainframe in Hawaii at the university if we were just a bunch of terminals scattered among the Hawaiian islands and they couldn't really easily talk to each other to get coordinated? How would they coordinate their sharing of this inbound radio channel? And Norm Abramson there at the University of Hawaii devised this very simple randomized retransmission procedure where a person would type. By the way, what they would type was a card image. It was 80 columns wide, back from the days of card batch processing. So you would type in your card image and hit send, and then your terminal would send it in toward the mainframe, and then would wait a short time to see if there was an acknowledgement returned on the outbound channel. And if there was, everything was hunky-dory. But if there wasn't, that probably meant the two terminals had decided to send at the same time. So then, as many terminals as participated in that collision of transmissions would then randomize and then retransmit at a random time in the future. Thereby, if they overlapped here, they very likely would not overlap again in the future because they would choose different random numbers to count down. So that's randomized retransmission multiple access.
This approach appealed to Metcalfe because he wanted to have multiple personal computers sharing a single Ethernet cable.
Since I was trying to avoid this big rat's nest of wires and only wanted to have one wire, just one wire, not 16 or 32 or whatever the alternatives were, just one, I wanted a distributed solution to how to share this cable, and the Aloha network produced that using randomized retransmissions.
If Ethernet was going to be a single long shared cable, it was important to see how data could be transmitted at high speeds over long distances.
So one of the first things I did was to buy a kilometer of cable, or it may have been a mile. I don't know if I'd gone metric yet. But a spool of coax cable about this big with the two ends sticking up. So I got a pulse generator, and I hooked it up to one end and hooked it around back into the oscilloscope and started launching square waves down the cable and watching what came out. I thought that would be good preparation for building a network. And what came out the other side wasn't a square wave. It was sort of lazy rise times and lazy fall times. But if you put a digital gate, you could recover the square wave. That is, you just use the digital threshold, and so out of this gate came a square wave. So you could recover at the end of a mile of cable this square wave. So I kind of knew, I kind of had some confidence then that various stations connected to this cable could inject their square waves, and the other guys could recover them.
Once Metcalfe was convinced that he could reliably send high-speed data over long distances using coax cable, it was time to define the details and build the hardware. He was joined by David Boggs, who had some experience working in a television studio. Boggs helped with both the hardware and software design. The team decided to use Manchester encoding to send the bits over the cable. In Manchester encoding, the first half of the bit time is the opposite of the bit's value, and the second half of the bit time is the bit's actual value, guaranteeing a voltage transition in the middle of every bit.
But the beauty of Manchester encoding was that while you were sending a packet, there were constant transitions. So if you listened, you could tell whether a packet was going by, and you didn't have to listen for long. You only had to listen for about a bit time, and then which turned out to be 340 nanoseconds. So you could wait that long and tell whether there was a packet going by. So one of the first differences between the Ethernet and the Aloha network, there are a lot of differences, but one of the first ones was carrier sense. In the Aloha network, you couldn't tell if somebody else was transmitting at the same time as you, but on the Ethernet, you could. And the advantage of that was, you might as well, if you're sending and somebody else is sending at the same time, you might as well give up because you've destroyed each other's packets, so punt. Then that recovers that bandwidth that would otherwise be lost to just continuing to transmit a damaged packet.
Another advantage of Manchester encoding was detecting collisions after you had started transmitting a packet.
The other thing was this Manchester code meant that the cable was on half the time and off half the time. That is, the driver, sort of an open, what we used to call an open collector driver, would either yank the cable up to 3 or 4 or 5 volts. I even forget the voltage now, but it was under 5, I'm sure of that. I had a rule, I never went above 5 volts. You would yank the cable up, and then during the other half of the bit, when you weren't yanking, you let go. So, for example, in each bit cell, you got to look to see if anyone else was transmitting when you had stopped. And if there was somebody else, then you had a collision. So that was the second feature.
In addition to carrier sense and collision detection, each packet had a source and destination address so that each workstation or printer could identify the traffic being sent to it.
And the scheme would be that each packet would carry two addresses, the address of the destination and the address of the source. And each of these would be 8 bits. And so on the back plane of these little personal computers with wire app, boom, boom, you would wire up in a code between 0 and 255, and that would be the serial number of the machine, and then you'd read that off the backplane and put it in the packet. So each packet had two addresses. This is different from the Aloha net, incidentally, which had one address, because the channel was only going, there were two channels. So two addresses, and we added a cyclic redundancy checksum on the end of the packet, which we implemented in hardware, so that you, in addition, so you could tell if the packet had been damaged. So if there was a collision and the terminal, the contending stations backed off, there would be a hunk of garbage on the cable zipping around. But when it was received, the checksum wouldn't add up and you'd just throw that chunk of garbage away.
In addition to designing the protocol to put the bits on the wire, the team also looked for devices to allow adding new workstations to the network without taking the network down.
So we wanted to put one cable down the middle of the corridor, and then every time you want to put a PC, you just run up and tap into it. And we didn't want the network to go down while you were tapping into it, because we wanted 24/7 access to the network, so there had to be a way to tap into the network without bringing it down. So that led to a device we found in the cable TV industry.
Okay.
It was called a Gerald tap, and it was basically a vampire tap. You'd drill a little hole in the outer casing of the coax, and then you would screw in this tap that would puncture the insulation and go right to the copper and tap in. And you notice in that operation, you're not breaking the copper. So the network continues sending, you tap in, and you're now part of the network. So a guy named David Liddell, who had done cable TV installations when he was in grad school in Toledo, suggested that we use the Gerald tap since it was already being made in volume and worked just fine as far as he was concerned.
Other computing companies became interested in using Ethernet-like approaches and started working with Metcalf, who decided that the best way to ensure interoperability among the various implementations was to develop a standard, which led to the formation of the IEEE 802 Working Group. Digital Equipment Corporation, Xerox, and Intel submitted the Blue Book Ethernet specification to IEEE 802 in 1980. But once word got out that the IEEE 802 Working Group would be developing a LAN standard, several Ethernet alternatives were quickly put forward. IBM claimed its token ring approach was superior, and General Motors championed a token bus as the best approach. The early efforts of the IEEE 802 Working Group were fraught with politics as the three solutions fought for supremacy. Ultimately, after a long battle, the working group standardized all three approaches as IEEE 802.3, Ethernet, IEEE 802.4, Token Bus, and IEEE 802.5, Token Ring, and let the market work out which technology it would adopt. Given the slow process, DEC, Intel, Xerox, and 3Com, which was Metcalf's newly formed company, decided not to wait and simply started building and shipping interoperable Ethernet hardware to an eager marketplace. One of the keys to 3Com's rapid success was that personal computer vendors didn't want to build network hardware onto the motherboards until the IEEE process had reached a conclusion. That meant that for many years, the only way to get Ethernet support for a personal computer was to purchase and install an expansion card. For a while, 3Com was selling well over 1 million Ethernet expansion cards per month. While 10 megabits seemed fast enough for personal computers in the mid to late 1980s, the Ethernet community always felt the need to go faster. According to Metcalf,
I helped found a company called Grand Junction Networks that introduced the 100 meg Ethernet. And I remember being at my coffee table. We were trying to think of how we would make a faster Ethernet. And there's some math that shows that as you go faster, the efficiency depends on the diameter of the network. And as you go faster and faster, the efficiency goes down, the diameter of the network in bits. And we were trying to go up a factor of 10, and then I don't know who it was, one of us observed that, wait a minute, we've been assuming that Ethernet is a kilometer in diameter, but we're all going to hubs now, so that we only need 100 meters, not 1,000 meters. And that was the factor of 10 right there. So by changing the collision interval, you maintain the same efficiencies, theoretical efficiencies, by just assuming you're going 100 meters instead of a kilometer. So that got us to 100 megabits per second.
Later, the IEEE 802.11 Wi-Fi standard implemented an Ethernet-like protocol using wireless transmission. Over the years, there have been improved versions of IEEE 802.11 with increased speeds, but even 100 megabits wasn't fast enough for the Ethernet community.
And now gigabit, 10 gigabit, which I guess is the mainstream now, and then 100 gigabit is now beginning to run. 100 gigabits per second. You can't be a computer scientist and build that kind of digital now. You have to actually be a hardware engineer to run it 100.
Yeah, I think at that point you're pretty much a radio person.
But then after 100 gigabits comes terabit. So I've already begun giving talks on terabit Ethernet.
Ethernet used the AlohaNet as a starting point and built on the concept of a shared transmission medium and randomized retransmission when data was lost. But a few design innovations from Bob Metcalf, David Boggs, and others who built that first Ethernet at Park form the foundation for nearly all modern LAN technologies. Adding source and destination addresses to every packet, carrier sense, collision detection, and CRC checksums. These patterns led to relatively simple LAN hardware solutions that are expensive to make and scale to very high levels of performance while making efficient use of the medium's available bandwidth. These patterns have served us well for the past 40 years. Ethernet's 40th birthday will be celebrated in style on May 22nd and 23rd, 2013, at the Computer History Museum in Mountainville, California. It'll be a gala event with industry briefings and all the many Ethernet inventors invited to come and share in the festivities and tell their stories. This column is from the May 2013 issue of IEEE Computer and is titled Bob Metcalf, Ethernet at 40. There is supporting video material for this column that you can find in the IEEE Computer Society YouTube channel or in the IEEE Digital Library. I'm the editor of the column, and I'm Charles Severance from the University of Michigan.